This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Good morning, everyone. My name's Bernard Keane. Welcome to the Adelaide Festival of Ideas and today's session, Using and Abusing Our Technology. First of all, I acknowledge that today we're gathered on the traditional country of the Kaurna people of the Adelaide Plains. We recognise and respect their cultural heritage, beliefs and relationships with the land. We acknowledge that they are of continuing importance to the Kaurna people living today, and we respect their elders past and present. Now, you may have been expecting Sophie Black, the lovely Sophie Black, to be hosting today. Unfortunately, she's had to bow out, so you're stuck with me as the MC / coordinator. It's a bit like the captain coach role. I don't know if AFL has captain coaches or whether they have those anymore, but it's a bit of a rugby league thing. A little bit of housekeeping. Those of you who've already been to some sessions will be able to sort of rehearse this off by heart. Please switch your mobile phone to silent. You are welcome, of course, to tweet. The handle and the hashtag is ADLFOI, so feel free to tweet up a storm or even Instagram up a storm if that's your thing. No unauthorised recording. The session is being recorded by Radio Adelaide for broadcast and future podcasts. Okay, well, to discuss the ever greater surveillance that technology is enabling, I'm joined by two quite remarkable people. And have a look at the conference website if you want to see the full list of their achievements. It's way too long to read out to you. But many of you, of course, will know Paul Davies from his time here in Adelaide in the 1990s. He's a theoretical physicist, cosmologist, astrobiologist, and most importantly of all, best-selling author. He is currently Regents Professor and Director at the Beyond Centre for Fundamental Concepts in Science at Arizona State University, where he also directs a major cancer research program. Ryan Schmidt is a laureate fellow at the Australian National University's Mount Stromlo Observatory, which I can see from my house. He's been at the ANU since 1995, which means he's been a Canberran for exactly 12 months less than me. Among the long list of global awards, medals, prizes and fellowships that he's got is the, just inter alia, the 2011 Nobel Prize in Physics, which he won jointly with Adam Rees and Saul Perlmutter. Now, I want to start with a summary of what we've learnt in the last 4 months, courtesy of the revelations of the whistleblower Edward Snowden and the debate that his revelations have prompted. So this is just a not necessarily comprehensive list of what we found out in the last 4 months via the FBI, the National Security Agency of the United States, collects telecommunications metadata direct from phone companies in the United States. The NSA collects internet usage data from major internet providers like Google, YouTube, Facebook, Skype, and Apple, and pays them for access. If you've used any of those products, your data has been siphoned off by the NSA. It compiles information from all those sources into a database that can be accessed without any authorization from within that agency. It compiles, we learnt this week, contact lists from popular email and mobile platforms. It has corrupted encryption standards and inserted backdoors into encryption products, including those used for commerce and financial transactions. It works with Anglophone agencies like our own Australian Signals Directorate to collect and distribute data. Its activities are ostensibly directed at terrorism, and in fact it has explicitly denied that it engages in economic espionage, but it spied on the embassies of the EU, India, Mexico, Greece and Turkey, the presidents of Brazil and Mexico, Brazil's Petrobras oil company. It spied on Brazilian mining companies. It spied on the United Nations media organisation Al Jazeera, as well as India and China. It's also spied on Kim.com, the flamboyant target of the copyright industry. And most critically, we know that much of what the NSA has done is illegal even under United States law. There have been thousands of breaches of US law in its programs, including according to its own audits, and the NSA admits its staff have stalked women using its facilities. The Director of National Intelligence has admitted he lied to Congress in denying the existence of such programs. and I'll give you a guess as to whether anyone's been charged in relation to any of that. And while this has been going on, the Obama administration has been engaged in an unprecedented attack on journalism and whistleblowers. US journalists have been subpoenaed and spied upon to track down whistleblowers. The Obama administration has used the Espionage Act to prosecute whistleblowers 7 times, which is more than all previous US administrations put together. That's going right back to George Washington. George is obviously a figure of derision for some in the audience. I quite liked him. The partner of journalist Glenn Greenwald was stopped by British authorities under UK anti-terrorism laws, detained and had his possessions taken from him. Journalist Barrett Brown, whose T-shirt you will see I am wearing, who revealed many links between the US government and the American cybersecurity industry, remains in a Texas prison facing charges totaling more than 100 years, including for sharing a link. And The Guardian was forced to go through the ridiculous theatre of destroying computer devices at the demand of the UK government. So it all sounds pretty bleak. There is some good news, though, or at least some less bad news. The National Security Agency has expressed frustration that it has not been able to penetrate the Tor network, a routing network that enables anonymisation, even though it closely monitors traffic that comes out of Tor nodes. If it hasn't succeeded in convincing companies to give it a backdoor, it can't penetrate high-level encryption products. The author of the Patriot Act, under which nearly all of the NSA surveillance is now conducted, Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner, has introduced or says he will soon introduce a USA Freedom Act. And that USA Freedom, it's all one word as an acronym. You know how American congressmen, women like to have acronyms? Well, he's cobbled together words to make up USA Freedom Act. USA Freedom Act that will dramatically curtail NSA surveillance on Americans, though not, of course, for the rest of us. The British Parliament's Intelligence Committee has now decided to conduct a semi-public hearing into mass surveillance by British agencies. And here in Australia, a push by the Gillard government to introduce mandatory data retention was derailed by our own Parliamentary Intelligence Committee, which resisted pressure from intelligence agencies and refused to back a data retention regime under which every Australian's telephone and internet usage data would have been kept for 2 years so that a wide variety of agencies could go back and look at it. So, gentlemen, to open up the discussion, I mean, it seems to me that there are two factors at work here. Most of us, whether we want to or not now, live a lot of our lives online. It doesn't matter if you haven't got a Facebook account. It doesn't matter if you're not on Twitter. You might do your banking online, you might order products online, we work online via email. Whether you want to or not, a lot more information about you is out there beyond your immediate control than in the pre-internet era. And the other aspect that's more recent, I guess, is that governments, the US government in particular, but other governments as well, have dedicated enough resources and enough technology and software so that the sheer volume of data online is now no longer an impediment to surveillance. They've got the capacity in terms of storage, in terms of computing power and software to find what they want in the ocean of data that's available. How does that sort of framing strike you both?
A very fair summary, I think.
Yes, so, I mean, we live in a new era where we have so much information out there. And I think we have concentrated, thanks to Snowden, on what the governments are doing with it. But I think the problem is more pervasive than that, because you don't actually have to have classified information or classified access to information with lots of computing power to figure out more than you might think about people. Because we leave our little digital fingerprints everywhere we go in many open senses. And that means that governments can go at them, but individuals can go through and learn huge amounts of things about people now, and organized companies certainly will be able to do that. And in some sense, I think governments we have the best chance of controlling because they ultimately are beholden to us. But I think the problem we have is that that information, you know, normally we take refuge and solace in individual bits of information that are not connectable. But that's no longer true. We can connect up all the little bits now And in that sense, we lose our the anonymity that we're used to having, and that's changed.
Well, you neglected to say that this is also being recorded by the National Security Agency.
Yes, welcome to our ASIO and NSA friends.
Everything I've learned about this subject since I started following it 2 or 3 years ago has alarmed me more. And the reason that I thought it was a good idea that we had a session like this is because Brown and I were at Google just after the Snowden news broke, and it was clear that Google were implicated very deeply in cooperating with the NSA. And they arranged a session like this, but with rather more people involved, including people at the sharp end of working with the National Security Agency. And that was very disturbing. But since then, I've been to a number of discussions involving people working for intelligence agencies or working on the technology that intelligence agencies use. And every time I ask a question, I get more and more alarmed. In other words, that everybody is aware there's a problem. The problem, I think, is far worse than you might imagine. And one whole area that you left out, but people are going to be familiar with, it's particularly bad in the UK, is surveillance cameras.
Offline surveillance. Yeah.
Right. And so you walk down a street in London and you're on 30 different surveillance records. Of course, a lot of these things are driven by technology, but as cameras become smaller and smaller, they'll be less and less obtrusive. They'll be all around us. Our whole environment will be and probably is to a certain extent already monitored. You see this little gizmo you've got here, that little, that tiny little thing at the top, you haven't put tape over it.
No.
Right. Anybody can hack into that and look at you at any time. I always have tape over mine. I was at...
I do too, by the way. Put a post-it note over your camera on your laptop. It's good advice.
And at the Google meeting, the person who was working with the NSA, this was pointed out to him as a joke, and he said, well, I do that too. that's the point is that we can foresee a time in the not-too-distant future when there'll be so much embedded surveillance, a lot of it for our own convenience, that it will make Big Brother in 1984 seem like a Vickers Tea Party. And I think the point we probably both want to make is that we can worry about governments and regulations and reigning in companies and so on, but given the march of technology, I think that the genie is already out of the bottle. We're not going to roll this back. There's no way that just by laying down regulations that we're going to reverse this. And part of the reason for that is that all these regulations are completely unpoliceable. There's absolutely nothing you can do to stop, for example, security agencies vacuuming up stuff they're not supposed to vacuum up. And as you know, in the United States, it's given a pseudo-legitimacy because if you're breaking the law, well, you change the law using a secret court that you don't tell anybody about, and then they've got carte blanche. Because it is so easy to suck up information about people and to analyze it, to look at the metadata, to look for patterns, and to store it forever and ever. You can't delete. Anyone who thinks they can delete in the cloud or anything that's gone out into the internet cannot be retrieved. It's there forever, searchable forever. And the usual defense is, well, we live in a liberal democracy. What are we worried about? We may not always live in a liberal democracy. And so the only hope I foresee, we may come onto that, is a fix at the level of the fundamental science. We can talk about that.
This is bad for... you talked about meeting with Google. This is bad for Google and other American companies. I mean, my trust in Google and in Apple and all those companies that were listed has been seriously eroded. I imagine the trust of most of their customers has been eroded. They didn't have a choice about complying with those laws. It's all very well for people to sit in Australia and say, well, you know, I'm not happy that Google's cooperated with the US government. Bad luck. They were required to and required to keep it secret. But nonetheless, I think Edward Snowden's made this point quite correctly. This is highly erosive of the business models of these companies, because if customers don't trust you with their data, they're not going to use your product. We saw this briefly with a sudden switch to DuckDuckGo, which is another search engine which doesn't store your records after the Snowden revelations. It's a tiny example of the erosion of trust, which is ultimately highly dangerous for a company like Google that relies on their customers trusting them to keep their information safe.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we visited Google, it became very clear that Google considers this to be probably, you know, among the biggest threats to their business that they have. And they are already thinking about how to deal with it, and it's pretty clear, and I would be surprised if this didn't happen, that Google would not start essentially breaking off fully independent subsidiaries in countries like Australia, which would then be subject to Australian law or to Dutch law or to English law, so that they can guarantee to Australians that, you know, you are at least protected by your own laws, not by our own. Because as we talk about, Google, most of the business that Google does now is not the U.S. It's everyone in the world. And so while the U.S. is trying to get some transparency for U.S. citizens, the transparency for you is zero. There is pretty much no place they cannot go right now, and that hasn't even been discussed within the U.S. And I think the problem Google has is they realize that that will allow competitors to come in and essentially take over their place for a reason that is outside their control. And so they will deal with this. It doesn't mean we still don't have a problem, because the information will still be siphoned up by various agencies, but that's how I see Google will deal with it. And Google truly believes that they need to have your trust to operate, and I think they want it, and I think they were not happy about having to comply with the NSA. And, you know, when they say they could have come out, which means that, you know, Larry Wall and Sergey Brin would have been put in jail and probably had treason charges put against them. That was sort of their opportunity. They could have done a Snowden, but, you know, that's sort of their choice, not to comply.
Paul mentioned the offline surveillance. I mean, there's not just CCTV. There's number plate recognition technology as standard now. There's drone surveillance is an easy option.
Face recognition.
Face recognition.
So, and also the latest is going to be any touch screen that can take your fingerprint. So every time you go to the bank, well, they're already on surveillance, but touching almost anything, the technology will be there.
And this is where you think you're okay, because, you know, face recognition software, it's not brilliant, but if you walk out here, wherever you're going tonight, you'll be on 50 different screens, and they only have to get it right 10 times out of the 50, and they know exactly where you've gone and what you've done. And that's fine if we have a benevolent government, but if it's not benevolent, or if it's not a benevolent agency that's doing it, it can be used to do, to completely have control over whatever it wants. That's the danger.
Right. The point that was put to me actually at Google by people as part of this program is that the danger is if the authorities want to trump up some sort of charge where you might technically be in breach of the law, but you know, it would be a relatively minor matter. They've got the ability to do that at any time. And what he was quoting is a very simple example. It wouldn't be that serious. But because you're on all these cameras as you drive and they've got all the numbers, they can figure out, well, you must have been speeding between there and there because they've got the times as well. That way of stitching somebody up is going to be, we become ever more vulnerable to that possibility. And if you think about what happens, say, in the former Soviet Union, or many countries which have shaky democracies. If they want to get somebody who's a political opponent, they're usually charged with tax fraud or something like that.
Yep.
Everybody is a tax cheat in some technical sense. There's just no possibility of complying with all of the tax laws. If they want to get you, they've got all that sort of information. And so the more that is gathered on people, the more opportunity there is, maybe in 20 years' time, to go back and say, right, well, don't like what you're saying about the government, we'll lock you up because you broke this, that law, and the other law. And so I see that as another big danger area.
And it's not just governments and companies, of course, it's all of us, because we've all got smartphones that have cameras on them. So we're all, in a sense, we're part of the panopticon. We see something happening. It might be good that it's filmed. We might see a policeman assaulting someone, and we're all standing there filming it. And the police, at least in Australia, have now started to work out that They may well be filmed. They do not have the right to go and ask people to stop filming, although some may try. It's quite different in the United States, of course, where the police still routinely, right across different jurisdictions, will try and stop people from filming them. But in Australia, at least, police forces have worked out that they are in the panopticon themselves. But it's not just smartphone technology, of course. Google is busily working on Google Glass, or I think Google Glass is now... is the first stage. They're now moving on to the next stage. But
there were people wearing those things at
Google Meet. I had someone show it to me, and I had to walk off to a session. It turned out to be Sergey Brin, who was trying to show me Google Glass. I walked away from him. I was like, that may have been a mistake, but anyway. Nice to meet you, Sergey.
Nice. Well, Google Glass and then wearable computers with cameras, with suitable software, of course, is a perfect surveillance device because you can look at anyone and identify who they are and call up all sorts of information. So right. It seems to me a wonderful law enforcement tool for your average policeman walking the beat.
But we recently had a lecture at Arizona State University from David Brin, a science fiction writer, who foretold a time in the not-too-distant future when you would be walking down the street and literally at the press of a button, you get the full biodata, whoever the people around you, including, you know, you could get even their medical records because that is one big area of concern, is that you think your medical records are safe. They're clearly not, because the NSA, for example, has broken the encryption that is normally used for those. And my feeling is that because if any organization has access, they can always be hacked, and it's not just the NSA. It might be the mafia, or it might be a foreign government. They can get access to that data. Get access to medical records, then it opens up the possibility that people be denied medical insurance because of pre-existing conditions, all those sorts of things, if that data isn't confidential.
And if you dilute encryption standards, then it affects everyone. I mean, if we all rely on having, you know, our financial system relies on having effective encryption for transactions. If the NSA has diluted, which it has, diluted the quality of encryption standards, then ultimately, we all suffer. It makes it easier for criminals.
Yeah, so it's certainly you don't want to have diluted encryption standards, because if someone can figure out, everyone can figure out. And so one of the recent claims is that the standard RSA, which is what most of us would use when we encrypt things, has had a very clever backdoor put into it, where it may well be that you can solve for the encryption faster than you otherwise would be through some mathematical technique, which is, that the NSA knows. I would still say there's a lot of speculation because of the lack of transparency of what's going on, and it's not completely clear to me, you know, how deep the crack is if you read at it in detail, and how pervasive it is. But technology will change that, and you know, we can easily do one tiny click and their ability to hack in will no longer be there. So we do have the ability to make encryption very, very hard to break, but you cannot guarantee into the future that some break, you know, some new discovery won't allow it to be broken. So quantum computing turns out to be able to make obsolete pretty much anything that is stored. So although they may not be able to break it now, in the future, if they can develop a quantum computer made to do this, then they'll be able to do it quite quickly.
Well, let's talk about that. So we've the governments, corporations, ourselves, we're now becoming one giant surveillance society. We can't regulate this. We can't draw it in. So cryptography has got to be, effective cryptography has got to be crucial here. So
right. So the quantum story cuts both ways. As Brian was saying, quantum computing could enable you to break stupendous classical encryption algorithms with relative ease. But the flip side is that quantum mechanics provides a means of totally secure encryption, and totally secure not in the sense that it becomes technologically cumbersome to break the encryption, but it's protected by a law of nature. And let me just explain this very briefly. That quantum mechanics associates with small objects, atoms and electrons and so on, a wave nature. And you can arrange quantum states so that these waves cohere with each other in a well-defined way. And what I mean by coherence, what I mean is if you throw two stones in a pond and you see two wave trains where they meet and overlap, they reinforce when they're in phase and they work against each other when they're out of phase. And this pattern of interference is something that is maintained only so long as the phase relationships of the waves are maintained. And quantum waves are a bit like that. What happens in a quantum system is that if a measurement is made, if the system is observed, it's coupled to some macroscopic system and information is read out, it immediately destroys that coherence. And so here you have a possibility of a system that can store information where if anybody takes a peek, it immediately transforms what is there. Not necessarily destroying the information, but making it clear that it's been read. So quantum mechanics, and there's a whole field called quantum cryptography, which is in its infancy, but it's making great strides, which aims to encrypt information through the wave nature of quantum systems. You, Brian, you could probably do a better job than I just did.
Yeah, so there's a classic thing known as the Schrodinger's cat, where you've got a box, it has a cat in it, and then there's a little vial of poison that is very, you know, tipped on a ledge, and it's just, you know, 50% of the time it breaks and kills the cat, and 50% of the time it doesn't. Now, you've got this box closed, and either the cat's alive or dead. You don't know, because you don't know what's happened in that. And when you open the box, suddenly know that the cat is alive or dead. So you have one time, okay, not a big deal. If you do that 1,000 times or 1,000,000 times, you will realize that some fraction of the time the cat's alive and some fraction of the time the cat's dead. It's when you open the box, you know what's going on. Before you open the box, you don't. You have a system that is uncertain. It is either the cat is alive or dead. That's all you can know about it. Atoms work in much the same way. They're sitting there, and they're in this state where they have these puddles of highs and lows. And so they're sitting there, and we don't know what state. They're sort of in all states at all the same time. And when you measure it, suddenly you can take that pattern, and you can say, for example, the electron is here, as opposed to the electron being this pattern. And so by measuring it, you suddenly take it from being in all of these places to being in one place, and that breaks it. So that if you do that, I'm trying to send a message to you, you can go through and say, I'm going to measure it, thank you. And if he does it, suddenly when you measure it, you see something different. You've broken that state. And so it means there is no way for me to get information to you with him listening in without you knowing about it. And as soon as you know about it, you stop the system, say, we're broken. And so you get one bit of information, that's it. The problem comes with storing. So ultimately, this is a great way for me to get from information to A to B, but if you want to keep B, then it becomes a little more problematic.
Yes, in principle, you can store things quantum mechanically, but in practice, it would have a very short lifetime. So,
well, and even if you can break that,
when
the difficulty
is very short. I assume you mean in a extraordinarily short.
Yes, one second or something. Yeah. But let's say that even we figure out how to do it for years. That means the NSA comes in and steals all your information because you're not limited to the one bit at a time. They can take the whole thing, and you come and say, damn, someone's come in and stolen all information, but they have your information. You're screwed. So that's the danger of storing the information still is problematic.
And on the positive side, quantum cryptography offers not merely we know that third parties have accessed it, but it offers the potential of not just practical inviolability, but it can't be broken. It's not just that it can't be broken now or in five years' time with extra computing power. It can never be broken.
It will never be broken, and it's very good for getting information from point A to point B. You'll be able to do that absolutely securely with pretty much no way out, unless they build a back door into the equipment, which is the thing we keep on worrying China doing, but it's pretty clear the NSA is doing it already. So
it's always important to distinguish in science when something people say something's impossible, whether they mean it's technologically infeasible or whether it violates a law of nature. We're talking about something which is impossible in the sense that it violates a law of nature. It's as impossible as me walking on the ceiling.
Because we have been assuming for a long time that a lot of the current encryption, high-level encryption, can't be broken, except with truly vast amounts of computing power that 5 years ago we just assumed wouldn't, you know, it wasn't practically. No one had the money and the data and the electricity to do it. Turns out now, well, of course, the NSA's been building its data center in Utah. I understand they've had some problems with it, but nonetheless, they've got the technology and the resources to actually attempt to.
I think right now, brute force. If you're running like 2048-bit encryption, which is what everyone should be running if you want to have, you know, two or three decades worth of clearance before things get broke, assuming no quantum computers are made, I think you're pretty secure, assuming you're using a system that does not have a back door in it. So the problem is, right now we use two prime numbers, and prime numbers, when you multiply them together, make a very, very big number, and it turns out it takes a million years worth of computer power to figure out what those two prime numbers are, which are what you use to send information around. With a quantum computer, you can actually do those calculations quite quickly, but without it, there's no real way around it, except there are mathematical tricks that for certain types of prime numbers, you can solve them quickly. And what is speculated but not proven is that the NSA has somehow put a mathematical trick in the wider algorithm. I don't know if this is true. This is speculation. And that would seem to be implicated in these things that came out from Snowden a month ago, that they have a way to break encryption. Well, they're going to break encryption, but they don't have powerful enough computers to do it unless they have quantum computers. But we know Australia has access to whatever the program is compared to the leak, and I'm pretty confident we don't have a quantum computer here because they're not just something you put on an airplane and move around.
Right. Now, for the benefit of those people here who have no idea what a quantum computer is, and if you want to just have a little bit of science.
It's presumably not very small.
The idea is, well, the way I like to describe it is computers get faster and faster and their innards get smaller and smaller, but at some point you come down to the atomic level, can't shrink below that, and you might think that's a fundamental impediment to the power of computers. And in particular, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle says that what goes on at the atomic level is intrinsically uncertain. It's part of what we've been talking about. So you think that would be a barrier to computation. But you can turn a sin into a virtue by actually harnessing some of these, some of this quantum trickery. And one way, it sounds a bit sensationalistic, but I have friends who will defend this description. One way of thinking about it is think of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. You fire an electron at an atom, and it maybe bounces to the left or maybe bounces to the right. You do the identical experiment, identical state next time, and it goes the other way. The favorite way of thinking about this today is that there are really two worlds or two universes, one with a left-moving electron, one with a right-moving electron, each complete with their observers and labs and equipment. And so that every time that there is a quantum transition, we can think of there being a differentiation between many worlds that start out identical and then become slowly differentiated. So in quantum mechanics, the best way of thinking about it is that there's actually an infinite number of universes overlapping each other in what we call a superposition. It's like a hybrid reality of all of these universes. And so if you compute at the quantum level, you're in effect doing massive parallel computation in all these universes, and then you bring the result together at the end.
And that comes back to what we talked about, Schrodinger's cat, where before you measure it, everything is there. All that information is there. It's in all things. So you can literally set up the atom to behave in a way where it makes a huge calculation, and the result, of course, is when you measure it, is it's gone through and set this wave pattern to do the calculation, and it's sort of done all of those infinite or almost quasi-infinite calculations for you. You have to be very smart. It's very mathematical, but right. Incredibly powerful when you get it right.
The reason this is tricky is to maintain control over all those phase relationships I was talking about, which is, in effect, that all these different parallel worlds are coherent and not just a juxtaposition. To do that, you have to, the environment of the system is always intruding. There's always noise coming from that environment, thermal noise in particular, which will tend to break down those delicate relationships. So in order to get this to work, you have to not only set everything up at the atomic level, but you've got to cool it down to close to absolute zero and screen out the environment. It's a very difficult thing to do. And this has been a painstaking program of research, some of which has been done here in Australia over the last 10 years or so. And it really has got to the point where only a few little toy calculations can be done, but there is an enormous amount of money being put into this. And we could foresee a time, if it's going to be successful, in maybe 10 years or 20 years, where this will become commonplace. So, and there are claims by, there's a company in Vancouver, in Canada, who claims that they're marketing a device. Google bought one, apparently, called D-Wave. Whether it is real quantum computing is a matter of dispute. So we're sort of on the cusp of developing that technology. And remember, quantum computing is the side that will enable all classical encryption to be broken. And quantum cryptography is the answer to that, which is the way of encoding information so that if anybody peeks, immediately it collapses the system and their intrusion is obvious.
So that would be a threshold moment then. All previous encryption would be redundant and pointless, and henceforth, potentially, all encryption would be unbreakable.
With the quantum
unless you knew the company and you got to put the back door in.
As I said, you can do the back door, which is where you essentially you have this system which is unbreakable. So you at the when you have the information before you put it in the unbreakable system, that's where you get into it. So you have that back door, so you don't have to go through the unbreakable system. That's always the easiest way. It's like the easiest way for the NSA to get all your information. It's not to break your encryption. It's to steal your lousy password, which they stole from someplace when you put it on an open website or through an open connection. That's the easy way to do it. Mm. And I promise you, they like taking the shortcut, and we all give them that opportunity by screwing up one time in the million transactions we do over a decade. And then, of course, we're very convenient because we never change our passwords because they're hard to remember.
Yeah, and we use the same password for every single account. Yeah. So. You both met with, you were just talking about this, Brian. I mean, you both met with intelligence people in various capacities. I mean, what's your, talk about their mindset in relation to all this. I mean, is this a, do they want the sort of all-you-can-eat option? Any technology that they can get that will allow them more information, doesn't matter what, that do they want? Or is that, do they have their own concerns about the job that they are being asked to do by governments? Because ultimately they are being asked but to do this by politicians, by governments. They're not, certainly not in Australia. They're not often a frolic by themselves. They are.
Yeah. So the people we met, and there is probably a selection effect because they didn't send Dr. Strangelove to Google, so we didn't get that person. But the person we got was very deeply thoughtful. I would say of very liberal politics, and who was interested in doing the right job for the country. And genuinely felt that the NSA needed to be held to a greater level of transparency, and that I think the view was that they could still do what the country needed, 99% of it being in a much, much more transparent system, so that we all sort of knew and had trust and confidence in the system. I mean, the reality is there's so much information, as I said, out there. In an open and transparent system, they can still learn everything you want on them. And the best thing to do is if you have a transparent system for government officials to do what they did in Australia and say, actually, we don't think this is a good idea because we don't think we're going to be elected the next time if we do this.
But the question is, do governments even know what their own security agencies are up to?
Parts of the U.S. system, I think, does. And the fact that it's
but not
transparent.
The president. He said he was shocked by these revelations. But maybe that was just bluster. So, but I was just reading an article by a former British minister of, I can't remember, maybe it was defense, who said that he was in cabinet debating releasing £1.8 billion to upgrade the Home Office's data acquisition and storage capabilities. All the time, GCHQ had got all that data. Yep. Nobody had thought to tell the Cabinet, it's redundant, you don't need the $1.8 billion, we've got it all for you, we'll sell it to you. So how much do the governments we elect actually know what their own security services are up to?
So if you have a non-transparent system, you can get pockets where rogue elements can do the wrong thing. People can go out and, you know, perv on their girlfriends or whatever because it's not transparent. And so that's why I think transparency is absolutely essential, so that we do know as much as we can. And so and that was what the NSA people who were brought there advocated. They said, we need an open and transparent system. We don't have one right now.
So it's important to stress that these people think they're on the side of the angels because they think our society is under attack from all sides and it needs to be defended. And it may seem draconian that they vacuum up every bit of information that's out there and then use super-duper computers to look for patterns. And I'm sure that as a technique, that's probably quite a good way of spotting a plot going on, some sort of terrorist communications. You could probably get that. The question is really, that we have to ask, is how far are we prepared to throw away hard-won rights and freedoms for this, in the name of this nebulous war on terror, or whatever you might call it. My parents and their parents fought for the civil rights that we have taken for granted through my life. A lot of those have just been thrown away in the last 10 years because, well, there's a terrorism threat. Thrown away without scarcity of thought. It's very hard to get them back again. And what has dismayed me most is the very muted response in the countries that I'm familiar with, the United States, the UK, and Australia, very muted response to pulling the rug from taking away rights and privileges that they have enjoyed for many generations. And it's all gone in the space of a decade or so. And I don't think that we're going to get it back again. And I just think people should be standing up for that.
Right. And if you have an open and transparent system, the people can decide through their elected representatives what is done and doesn't. We always have a balance. I mean, we can make life safer against terrorism by doing more and more draconian measures, in the same way that we can make you all safer and not allow you to drive cars anymore, because cars kill people. And if we really want to make life safe, then we should not drive cars.
If you just want to save lives, it's very easy to use surveillance technology to do that. Every car would be fitted with a device that reports automatically on your speed in the various zone, and anybody caught speeding loses their license. You'd save thousands of lives by doing that.
And there's always a balance between, you know, what you restrict and what you allow. And in this case, you know, we allow all sorts of things to happen. Going through U.S. security, as we all know if you've been to the U.S. airport, is really a grossly unpleasant experience now. Mm-hmm. And if you do the benefit-cost analysis, probably does absolutely nothing.
Stupid.
They could do something that's 10 times less invasive and get 99.9% of the way there. So that's a place where you've lost the plot.
There's a sleight of hand that is central to the argument that's certainly been put forward about data retention, which is that agencies are, and this is the phrase I use, this is an FBI phrase, going dark, which is that as we stop using telephones in the traditional sense and we start using data, even for our telephone calls, telephone companies aren't recording, you know, what telephone calls we made. They don't need to. They're not billing us like that anymore. They're billing us on data consumption. And the going dark problem is that companies are no longer keeping phone records because they don't need to. And the argument from security agencies is, well, all we want to do is translate what we could do in the analog era to the digital era. We just want to know who people are calling, that sort of thing. And, of course, it's a completely fallacious argument because we don't use phone. We don't use the internet like we use phones. You know, we don't live a lot of our lives on the phone. We didn't live a lot of our lives on the phone. We didn't put our financial details on the phone. We didn't have relationships on the phone. We didn't work on the phone. There is a vast swathe of our lives that is now lived online, that is completely different and far, far bigger than anything we ever did with a phone. And yet they want to translate the same powers onto internet monitoring as they had with telephone monitoring.
But just because you're not making a call doesn't mean this isn't monitoring you. And in fact, the only way to be totally secure is to take the battery out.
Take the battery out, exactly.
And I checked this with a former British telecom engineer, and he said, yeah, they can be activated unless you take the battery out. And
it provides a perfect record of where you've been. The phone tower will record where you have been.
So it's doing that, of course.
But it's got a GPS in there that's being recorded, and so there's all sorts of stuff it can do.
Right. And so for all I know, in spite of the fact I've switched it off, it's recording everything we're now saying.
Julian Assange says mobile phones are surveillance devices that happen to be able to make phone calls.
Right.
He's absolutely right. I want to open the floor to questions. So there's a microphone strategically placed in the middle of the floor. So please do go to the microphone and I will invite you to ask your question. Please don't make statements, otherwise I'll be forced to use the dreaded phrase, "I'll take that as a statement." So,
sort of interesting that people are willing to surveil themselves these days with all the social media, even though they don't understand the terms and conditions of using that. My question is, was based around the only way not to be vulnerable is not to be connected, but lots of organisations and governments now encourage or enforce us to go online to do commercial transactions or whatever. How do we get off the web, off the networks, when the system is actually forcing us to go on it? At a time, when I finished my computer, I turned it off, switch off everything, take all the little wires, put it in the cupboard. But we increasingly can't do that. The system seems to be against us in being secure.
So I think the system, the problem is the internet is a piece of infrastructure that we take for granted in the same way that the government could require you to call them on a phone in the old days. They can require and compel you to use the internet now. And so the internet's much more powerful, and so the danger is much larger. But fundamentally, governments use the infrastructure available to supply services and interact with you. So you don't really have a choice. That's why it's important to get the arguments of transparency, encryption, and things right in this piece of infrastructure. And I think as citizens, we can demand that. But in the end, you have to trust your government to get the infrastructure right, but knowing it's imperfect. And I don't think there's a magic bullet.
The point I want to repeat is, trust the government. But because all this data is storable, at zero cost forever and searchable forever, it's not present governments we need worry about, it's future governments, and not necessarily the future Australian government, but any governments around the world that gain access to that data, because not everybody here in this hall can guarantee that they're not going to be living in Bulgaria or Kazakhstan or Argentina in 10 years' time, or their children, or whatever. And the laws there may be very different, and they'll have access to that information too. And it could well be that, it seems to me, that one more major terrorist incident in the United States, and if it was something as serious as the detonation of a dirty nuclear bomb or something like that in an American city, horrific scenario, but we all know it's a possibility, that after that, all bets are off.
Yeah.
Are people aware of... Also, we're not just talking about governments when it comes to accessing your data. We're talking about here in Australia. We're not merely talking about the police or ASIO or a financial regulator. The RSPCA can get your data. You get your phone data. Environmental regulators can get your data. They all have powers. Anyone who collects revenue or helps to enforce federal laws or state laws can ask phone companies for your data. They are allowed to under legislation. So the RSPCA can and does get people's telephone data in pursuing animal cruelty charges. Now, good on the RSPCA. I love the RSPCA like everyone else, but I'm not sure that allowing a organisation like that to be able to get access to people's data is actually the best way of regulating behaviour.
You were talking about investigative journalists and whistleblowers in the United States. We hear about pleading the Fifth Amendment and the right to bear arms. I would have thought in their Bill of Rights, even more fundamental than any of the others, is the right for free speech. So what tactics are used by the government and the, spy agencies to actually quieten or incarcerate those investigative journalists and whistleblowers to make sure that they're kept silent, well, maybe forever, effectively, certainly punished anyway?
Well, we've seen the most obvious demonstration has been Chelsea Manning, sentenced to 35 years for revealing war crimes, inter alia, and embarrassing the US government. There is a war on whistleblowers going on, and it's being waged by the Obama administration. That's why they have used the Espionage Act, an act developed during the First World War to deal with German spies, to pursue whistleblowers. Whistleblower after whistleblower. Thomas Drake, an NSA executive, who revealed quite staggering wastage of government money in the NSA by one of the United States' biggest defence contractors, in the hundreds of millions of dollars, prosecuted under the Espionage Act. He's just one of seven examples, including Edward Snowden, who will be charged if they can get their hands on him on the espionage. So the first thing is to intimidate whistleblowers, to send a signal to whistleblowers, if you go to the media with material that is embarrassing in any way related to national security, then we will engage in exemplary punishment. That's what Chelsea Manning got. And the journalists who've... Then it's a war on journalism. So secret subpoena powers are used to obtain phone records. Associated Press journalists had this happen to them. The Obama administration used subpoena powers to get their phone records to see who they had been calling so they could try and track down their whistleblowers. Same thing happened to Fox News's senior Washington correspondent. His Gmail account was subpoenaed by the Department of Justice so they could track down the whistleblower that gave him an embarrassing story. Now, all this is going on while the Obama administration routinely leaks top-secret information in its own political interests. Governments are not about secrecy. Governments are about information management. It's a crucial thing to understand. Governments will release top-secret information, information that shouldn't be released, if it's in their political interests. The movie Zero Dark Thirty, strongly based on secret information about the killing of Osama bin Laden, provided by the Obama administration. Shouldn't have been done, but was done because the Obama administration thought it was in their interest. So they will leak top-secret information when they want to. But if someone else does it in a way that embarrasses them, then they will throw the book at them, and those people will go to jail for a long time. So the full legal panoply that's available to the Department of Justice is deployed against whistleblowers and journalists in the United States who embarrass the Obama administration.
Some sort of test case that has gone to the Supreme Court and said right of free speech is paramount. I presume that hasn't happened, but could that in theory happen, that every American's got the right for free speech that supersedes any other rights of government, for example, and therefore the precedent is set to be able to make sure that, Americans anyway, can get whistleblowers and investigative journalists backed up by the law?
I don't think the right of free speech trumps national security.
Is that constitutional, though, the US Constitution?
They draw it into the suspension of the Constitution because it's considered to be in that military regime where espionage and things apply. So, you know, your rights are diminished in a time of war, and so what they have used as a trick is blurring, you know, war and peacetime in a way which ultimately means that, for example, if you work for the NSA, you take an oath of secrecy. They do provide an ombudsman, but it's very clear in the case of Snowden, Snowden didn't trust that ombudsman. And that's a secret ombudsman. And so, you know, the whole system is is one that is veiled in secrecy. It's not transparent, and so lots of things can happen. But I think the way around it is to hold your political leaders to say, this is not war. This is normal times, and therefore you need to be in the civil courts, not the military courts, and then what you've just said would apply. But when, as soon as you're in the military court, things are different.
Well, the problem is that the President of the United States, as Commander-in-Chief, can define war to be anything he wants to do.
That's right.
And so if there's a small group of terrorists, it's the war on terror, it's war, and the rules are suspended. Now, you might say, well, there's freedom of speech is one thing. What about the law? What about people who are being victimized? Can they not have recourse to the law? Let me tell you a horror story I learned at a meeting in Istanbul discussing exactly this topic, and in the presence of intelligence officers from several countries. And it was a man who runs a guitar factory in Nashville. Makes guitars, sells guitars. The factory was raided one day by armed officers from Homeland Security. They wouldn't tell him why. They seized his stock, seized all his records, and when he went to a judge to demand some sort of action, the judge said, if you're under investigation from Homeland Security, I cannot talk to you. This went on for months and months and months. You might think, well, what is this about? What it was about was that he had technically infringed a law that was protecting the rainforests of Madagascar. So he'd imported what was apparently a prohibited type of wood, in spite of the fact he had all the permits and necessary documentation in place, but there'd been some mix-up with the law, some switch in the law. This went on for months, cost him millions of dollars overall. And he told me that there are 23 agencies in the United States that can kick the door in, ostensibly under the umbrella of Homeland Security, 23 different agencies. So the problem is that recourse to the law is blocked to you in the name of Homeland Security.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what the situation would be here. Who can kick your door in? RSPCA.
RSPCA.
Yeah. Drag your dog away.
The Department of Health, the Department of Environment, they can kick your door in. Well, if they can't kick your door in, they can go to your phone company and say, where was this person at such and such a time and what phone calls did they make? We've got time for about one more question, I think. So there's someone hovering near the microphone. You're it, sir.
Thank you. So if you just look at the commercial world, I don't think we have the capability to secure your data. And if you look at the RSA or Lockheed Martin getting hacked, you know, and they've got unlimited resources or a lot of resources at any event, what laws would you like to introduce, you know, potentially to, you know, help retain your data private in that scenario?
Just on what's happened so far, the previous government, and I assume this government will continue with an effort to bring in mandatory breach notifications. So companies actually have to tell you if your data has been placed in danger. So that is one thing that I think will actually happen. The other thing that the Greens proposed during the election campaign, and I'll out myself as having had a little bit of a role in it, is a requirement for companies to do more to keep data about Australians in Australia and to tell Australians if they have to provide that data to other governments or to any government. So a requirement that says if Telstra has to give information to the US government, courtesy of its international operations, it tells the affected customers that such an agreement exists. And it reports annually on, if not the exact details, then the fact that it has provided that sort of information. So greater transparency is, you know, absolutely crucial to enabling it. At least if it's not about so much laws, but greater transparency, that means that as a consumer, as a business, if you're looking to store your data somewhere or you know someone is providing services to you, you can make an informed decision about who you pick as a service provider based on what you know of their record in securing data and where they keep it. Do they keep it in Australia, in which case it's subject to Australian laws for better or for worse? Do they keep it in the United States, or do they keep it with a company that is under US law? Either way, they're caught by the Patriot Act. and that information can be obtained. So it's about transparency and making an informed decision.
Yeah, and I would also say that when you get into encryption and things, that I am much, much more comfortable with open standards of encryption because I know exactly what's going on and it's out there for everyone. And that's what is interesting about the questions around the encryption that banks and things use. Well, they actually don't use the open standards. They use their own ones. And those own ones you would think might be more secure, but they're not, because they're not subject to scrutiny all the time. And so I think having, as you say, transparency, and then I would say these open security standards, which are continually questioned, is probably the right way forward. It seems that one of the open standards, PGP, has been rumored not to be able to be broken yet by the NSA. And that's an oldie but a goodie, and still use it.
And it's very user-friendly. You can set up your email with PGP very, very easily. Yep. An idiot like me can do it. So. Yep. A final comment?
Well, I hate to end on a gloomy note, but my feeling is that whatever rules we might ask our leaders to put into place, they're so easily broken, and easily broken without anybody knowing, that I don't have very much faith in it. And so I think we are moving to a new form of society, the total surveillance society. And if I can end on a philosophical note, I think that most people, few scientists, but most non-scientists, have the impression that they have some sort of free will. That is, that they are autonomous agents able to make decisions about their own fate. Many scientists will say that it's an illusion. But anyway, it's an illusion that most people have. I foresee a time in the not-too-distant future when, seeing as we know that everything we're doing, saying, and even thinking is going to be positioned in a bigger community, not just government, but everyone knowing about this, that we will lose any sense of ourselves as free, autonomous agents. So we're moving to a society where, like ants, they're moving as part of a community. The community may have a strategy. Each individual ant is subordinated to that. They think it's free. We know it's not. I think that illusion of human freedom is about to evaporate. So that's a profound and provocative statement.
I'm
not sure it's good
news or
bad
news. Depressing one. Thank you. on that hideously depressing note, I want to thank our two guests today. It's been a wonderful discussion. Thank you both, Brian Schmidt and Paul Davis.
This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.